One cold morning in January of 2011, I put on my best suit and I walked into a big white government building full of lawyers. Now, this is the Federal Trade Commission building just down the street on Pennsylvania Avenue. Now, many of you I know would run screaming from a big white building full of government lawyers. Many of you, I'm sure, would prefer to walk into a Sharknado, which is just as scary but at least has a more reasonable dress code. Nevertheless, I did. I went to this place most every workday for about a year and a half, as our friend Steve Bellavin has done for about a year after me. I want to talk today about what it was like, about what I learned there, about how to be a technologist working with people in government, what it's like to work with buildings full of lawyers. And I want to talk especially about what we as a community can do and need to do in order to interact more effectively with the people who make decisions that affect not only us, but also the users of all of our technologies. Now, the first thing to talk about, indeed maybe the only thing to talk about in discussing how to work, what it was like to work in this area and what it's like to work with policy people, is the differences in culture. I really felt in many respects like I was crossing a border when I went between Washington and back home to Princeton every week. There are big differences in the way people behave, in the way people think, and I'm going to spend a bunch of time talking about that. I learned in going back and forth how to pass in either community, how to adopt, let's say, the mode of dress of Washington people, or when coming out to meet folks like you, how to adopt the mode of dress of the technical community. Thank you very much. All right. Now that I'm appropriately dressed for this audience, let me talk about this very real gap in culture and behavior. And it's no secret that there's a certain amount of suspicion across this boundary between technologists and policy people. You all remember our friend Senator Ted Stevens and his famous statement about the Internet.
The Internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.
Okay, so we had our fun with this, right? We made our, we labeled our tubes as Internet. Even Jon Stewart had fun with this one. Although if you think about it, what Senator Stevens said in that quote is not so ridiculous. We talk all the time about the internet or networks in terms of pipes. We say, have you filled the pipe? How long is the pipe? We need a bigger pipe, and so on. Pipe, tubes, not so different. Nonetheless, this became such a huge meme, and it became something that we still remember and laugh about now, because it tended to confirm the stereotype we had that people in the policy world and in politics just don't get it when it comes to the internet. Now, of course, they don't always have the highest opinion of us. In the view of, I think, too many people inside the Beltway, the typical technologist is like this guy, some loser sitting in his, and it will always be his, in that, at least in that stereotype, parents' basement, clicking away on a smoke-stained IBM XT keyboard. Indeed, just I think last week, here's Michael Hayden, the recent director of the NSA, talking about a bunch of 20-somethings who haven't talked to the opposite sex in 5 or 6 years. So we don't have the best reputation in the policy world either. Now, the good news, at least slightly good news for us, is that SOPA and PIPA happened, that there was this big sort of uprising that people in Washington noticed, that at least suggested in the minds of many people in the political world that there was something important going on in this technology world, that maybe these technology people actually have voters and public opinion on their side in some respects. And so people in the political world at least believe, I think, that they need to pay attention to us. And that gives us an opportunity. Nonetheless, we still have this rather awkward problem of how to actually meet and work with these people who are very different from us. I love this picture so much because it looks photoshopped, but actually it's not. Elvis and Nixon really did look that different, and Elvis does just pop out of this image in a way that Nixon doesn't. But this, is more or less what happens. I think too often when we go to meet and talk with people in the policy world. So I want to talk about how to be Elvis and work with Nixon a little bit. So first, let me take a quick detour and talk about my job and what I did. Because one of the things I learned early on in dealing with government is that it's a big mistake to think of the government as a single monolithic entity that has one opinion and one goal and one strategy. Government consists of a whole bunch of different offices, agencies, and entities, which are often at cross purposes and often for good reasons. So let me talk about my agency, the FTC. The FTC has two main missions. The first mission is consumer protection. That means protecting consumers against unfair, deceptive acts or practices in commerce. So if somebody is ripping somebody off on the internet, it's the FTC's job to do something about it. That's a big job. Actually, if somebody's ripping people off the internet, it's also the FTC's job to do something about that, although I didn't work on those cases as much. The second thing the FTC does is it shares with the Department of Justice the antitrust or competition mission in the US government. And if you think about it, that's also a form of consumer protection. The whole purpose of antitrust law is to maintain competition, because competition is the best guarantee that consumers will have a fair deal offered to them. So that's the FTC's mission. It's primarily a civil law enforcement agency. Doesn't bring criminal cases against people, but most of what the agency people do on most days involves investigating, filing, and carrying out civil law enforcement actions. My job as the chief technologist at the FTC basically involved three sorts of things. First, I was a policy advisor to the chairman, who's the head of the agency. During my time there, the chairman was John Leibowitz. That means that if the chairman was having a meeting with some important person, if he was discussing some important decision related to technology, I was there in the room. He was the boss, he made the decisions, but I was at least part of the conversation and hopefully giving him good and helpful advice. Number two, I was an internal technology consultant within the agency. That meant if anyone in the agency had some technology issue that went beyond their local expertise, they could come to me for help. Sometimes I would just answer a question. Yes, the thing that company is saying to you does make sense. No, it doesn't make sense. Or just go call this person. But sometimes I would dive rather deeply into a serious technical issue. For example, when I was at the FTC, the agency did a big antitrust investigation related to Google search. And so I spent a whole bunch of time digging into the details of how modern search technology works and the evidence about Google's behavior and choices and so on. And that factored into the decision that the agency ultimately made. Third, I was an ambassador to the tech community. That means coming and talking to groups like this. It means talking to people in the tech industry, talking to tech companies, and generally promoting a flow of information and understanding between the FTC, the big white building full of lawyers, and the tech community. Two things I didn't do and was glad not to do were, first, management. I had nobody reporting to me and no budget for the first time in a long time, and that was actually really nice. And second, I didn't have any infrastructure. If the network went down, it wasn't my phone that rang. So my job, if you look at all three of these items, all three of them are really about this: working with someone who comes from a different world than you do. So let me talk and dig in more detail into how to do that. We often have an idealized a view of what it means, what it's like for an expert and a policymaker to interact. So here's an expert and a policymaker. And in our oversimplified and optimistic model, the expert has access to truth. And there's some kind of communication protocol that operates between these two, with the idea being that the truth gets conveyed to the policymaker so that they can make good decisions. And we all wish it worked this way, but it often doesn't. You see very often something like this. Someone who sort of wears the mask of an expert, who comes in and throws up a big cloud of jargon and says, trust me, this is the way it has to be. And policymakers often are in that situation. And we find this, people from our community especially, people who come out of science or come out of applied technology, find this deeply aggravating. And the reason we find this so aggravating and difficult to deal with is that it reflects a fundamental truth that we don't want to deal with, and that is this: that politics is not a search for truth. In our world, we at least pretend, or on our good days, actually achieve the goal of having our discourse be a search for truth. People stand up at this conference and they give papers. People stand around a whiteboard with pens and they try to solve a problem. And we're at least pretending, we at least are obliged to pretend that we're trying to agree on truth and trying to learn from each other. That's not what politics is for. Politics is not like the West Wing. We don't have sophisticated, citation-laden discussions about great issues of state while striding briskly down hallways. Most of the time, we are dealing with bogus things that people say. So here's a bogus thing that I heard a lot. Something is not technologically possible. Now, sometimes when people said this, they were right. Sometimes they made the opposite thing of saying, oh yeah, we can do that easily when that involves solving the halting problem. But non-technologically possible is something that we heard a lot, and I thought a lot about how to debunk it. The best way to debunk it is to send them back the code for doing it. Here's some code I wrote to say that, no, actually you can do that. Here's a 9-line program I wrote in 10 minutes. You also see a level of rhetoric that is not at the high level that we see from almost everyone in this community. This guy, for example, wrote in one blog post the following insults. He talked about mob rule, called someone a Bolshevik and a star chamber. This, by the way, was in response to a suggestion that it might be a good idea to let users control their third-party cookies. So overheated rhetoric and bogus claims, politics is not a search for truth. All right, so how are we going to deal with that? Well, the first thing we need to do to deal with this is to recognize that the fact that politics is not a search for truth is often a feature rather than a bug. Why? Because politics is how democracy plays out, and democracy is not a search for truth. What democracy is an algorithm for resolving disagreements. And it's an algorithm that has a bunch of desirable properties, right? The algorithm is simple. We need to do X or we need to do not X. Raise your hand if you want to do X. Raise your hand if you want to do not X. Which one had more hands? Well, we'll do that. That's actually a very nice algorithm in many ways. No question is undecidable. You can always have a vote. All questions, in fact, are decidable in constant time. And that is an important feature. They don't always get decided in constant time, but they are decidable. You can decide what to do without needing to decide on the underlying facts. You can decide whether or not to have a carbon tax and how big it should be without having to decide first how much the sea level will rise if you don't do it. We can decide whether we need to have SOPA or PIPA without needing to decide exactly how the DNS will get busted if we do. And that's a good thing. We can reach a decision with no need for producing a coherent explanation for why we did it. After an election, there are all kinds of explanations for why the voters did what they did, but at the end of the day, the result of the 2012 presidential election is that Barack Obama is president and Mitt Romney is not. The rest is just commentary. And the fact that we don't have to agree on why we did what we did in order to decide is also a useful feature. So democracy has a lot to recommend it, even though it's not a search for truth. And yet, we still don't seem so happy, right? Often, individual policymakers, individual legislators, seem to behave in ways that are logically inconsistent. And they seem to behave in ways that are indifferent to truth. And we find that hard to understand and hard to deal with. But politicians behave that way for a reason. Not necessarily because they're stupid or corrupt, although, you know, some of them probably are. But most are not. In order to understand why it is that politicians often behave the way they do. Whoa, that's bad. Politicians behave that way for a reason, and let me talk about why politicians behave that way in terms of computer science. So consider the following model. Let's model the options that government has as a set of proposals. We'll call P the universe of proposals, and the specific proposals on the table we'll call P0, P1, P2, etc. And we'll assume these proposals are independent, meaning that the effect or desirability of adopting one is not affected by adopting the other. So there's no fratricide between them. And we'll say that a bill, a thing that government is considering doing, is a subset of all the possible proposals. All right, we'll assume that a voter has a utility function, U sub I for voter I, which says how much they like or dislike a particular proposal. And we'll say a voter supports a proposal if their utility function on that proposal is positive. And now we'll say that a proposal passes or would pass if a majority of voters support it. All right? That all kind of makes sense. All right. And we'll make an assumption that the behavior of voters is sensible in a certain sense, that given two bills that are disjoint, B1 and B2, meaning they have no proposals in common, and remember we assume the proposals are independent, that what a voter thinks about doing B1 and B2 together is just their utility on B1 plus their utility on B2. Right? So there's a simple corollary from this you can easily prove. Given two disjoint bills, if a voter supports B1 and a voter supports and that voter supports B2, then the voter will support those two things bundled together. This is just the statement that the opinions of voters, their utilities, are logically consistent. Okay. So now, given this fact about the behavior of individual voters, we then want to move on to prove a theorem that says that the same holds for the result of democracy, that given two disjoint bills, if they both pass separately, then the combination would pass, except that's actually false. Here's a counterexample. Here we have three voters, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and two bills, B1 and B2. And you can see that Alice likes B1 but really hates B2, Bob likes B2 but really hates B1, and Charlie likes them both. So B1 passes with two votes from Alice and Charlie, B2 passes with two votes from Bob and Charlie, but the combination is voted down. Only Charlie supports it. And in fact, if you think about it, the strongest result you can prove is that if B1 passes and B2 passes, then there must be somebody who will vote for the combination. But in general, no more than one person. So the outputs of democracy are not logically consistent, even if the opinions of individual voters are. Now, you might think we can fix this. Well, maybe majority vote is a mistake. Maybe there's some other way we can do it. Maybe we can have some more complicated algorithm. We'll ask the voters to give us utilities or to rank all the outcomes, and we'll compute the convex hull or some crazy thing. Turns out there are fundamental impossibility results in political science that say you can't fix this. This is the way it is. Inputs consistent, logically consistent. Outputs of a vote, not logically consistent. All right, let's generalize the model. Now we'll partition the voters into districts. And we'll say that there's a legislature with one representative per district, and the job of the legislator is to do exactly what their constituents want. The representative will support a bill if and only if a majority of their constituents would support it. That's what a legislator is going to do in our model. Okay? Now, what are the implications of this? Well, first, the behavior of a legislator is not logically consistent. They might support B1 and B2 separately, but not support the union. Why? Because what the legislator does is determined by majority opinion of their constituents, and we already know that majority opinion doesn't give us this consistency property. Also note that the legislator in this model doesn't care about the facts. Why? All they care about is whether more of their constituents are for or against the proposal. The constituents presumably care about the facts, but the legislator is just in the business of counting. So remember this slide from before? What frustrates us about legislators? Their behavior is logically inconsistent and indifferent to truth? Well, here's a simple model that predicts that that's what they would do. Now, of course, real life is more complicated than that. We haven't talked yet about legislative strategy. Because these bills, these combinations of proposals that are being decided don't just drop from the sky. Members of the legislature, the party leaders and others, committee chairs decide what the bills will be. So let's think about legislative strategy. Consider the following problem, the amendment problem. We're given some base bill B and a set of amendments A1 through AN that we might consider adding to it. Let's assume these are all disjoint from each other. And so the question is, can you add a subset of these amendments to the base bill to make a proposal that will pass? That's NP complete. It's a fun problem to prove it. There's a simple reduction from 3SAT or any other number of ways to do it. But this simple legislative strategy problem turns out to be NP complete. So maybe these guys are smarter than we thought they were. The real world, it turns out, is even more complicated than that. The behavior of voters is not self-consistent in real life because voters, turns out, are people. People don't behave self-consistently. Voters apply heuristics to decide what to do, and heuristics, although they are very useful and often an efficient use of resources, don't give you self-consistent answers. Legislators make deals that extend beyond just voting for or against individual bills. I'll vote for this if you vote for that. I'll withdraw my amendment if you agree to give me a chit later, and so on. All kinds of deals get made and that go outside that model. So the real-world model of legislative strategy is even more complicated than what we've seen so far. Now, it gets even worse in a real government because you have not only a legislative branch, but an executive branch. I worked in an executive branch agency. Executive branch agencies, most of the people working there are not directly accountable to the voters. They're not directly elected by the voters. Instead, they're indirectly accountable to the voters. And this indirection makes things even more complicated. Okay, so what we have here is a system which tends to push people to behave in ways that seem logically inconsistent and indifferent to facts, where you have very complicated and indirect strategic issues, problems that people need to solve in order to get their work done. So it should be no surprise that locally, the system looks irrational. The people seem to be behaving in ways that are crazy and stupid. Why can't you do that thing even though it seems to make total sense? Well, the answer is that we're trying to solve some very difficult, complicated strategic problem in order to get something done, which even though it has support, is hard to do. And the fact that the system looks irrational locally doesn't necessarily imply that the participants are incompetent or corrupt. Indeed, if my experience in government taught me that virtually all the people I work with were very competent and certainly honest. There are a surprising number of people working really hard to do the right thing, well-motivated and mostly well-informed. And the mystery, the challenge, is to understand why it's difficult for them to do more than they do. The answer to this really is that when you talk about politics, it's complicated. Okay. So that's maybe depressing, or maybe it's interesting. What it tells us is there's something interesting to learn about there, and that's the kind of thing we like to do, a complicated system which we like to kind of probe and debug, tinker with. That's our kind of thing. But what should we actually do? What should we in our community, given that we care about the outcome of many of these processes, at the very least because they have the possibility of messing up what we do, what should we actually do? Well, one thing to do is to just sit back and say, it's not okay to not know how the internet works. All of you policy people, figure out technology and then come back to us and we'll talk. But we'll just go off into our labs and we'll write some code while you guys figure it out. Meanwhile, you've got a whole community of people in Washington and other capitals looking at us and saying, what do you mean? It's not okay to not know how government works. Throwing the same thing back at us, that what they do is just as interesting, complicated, and subtle and important as what we do. And if we're not willing to meet them halfway and actually have a conversation, we're not going to get anything done. So the question is how to work together. Let me talk about what I think I learned in my time in government trying to do that, because as I said earlier, I spent most of every day trying to work with people who were not technologists to try to get useful stuff done. So what does this look like from the side of the policymaker? The first thing that is clear from experience is that a policymaker needs to be a generalist. I would sit in a staff meeting at the FTC with Chairman Leibowitz at the end of the table, and there would be some decision that needed to be made about technology. And it involved a bunch of complicated technical issues, which I had studied up on and I understood, and I, you know, was able to give him a crisp explanation of why, you know, I thought the pros and cons were thus and such. But he had to make a decision. And you might think, well, he should learn all that stuff that I know and figure out how to decide. But the problem is sitting right next to me is somebody who needs him to make a decision about, say, something simple like healthcare economics or patent reform or any number of other issues which are just as difficult and complicated and which are just as much a career for a large number of people as our stuff is. The policymaker can't possibly hope to learn all of those details. What they have to be able to do is not to understand everything, but to make good decisions about it, which is a different skill. And there's hope here because we, in many parts of our lives, have learned how to make good decisions about stuff without being an expert. For example, if you needed to decide whether to have knee surgery, you could probably make a good decision about that, even though you're not an expert in orthopedic surgery. How would you do that? Well, you'd identify experts, you'd talk to them, you'd BS detect what they're saying, you would learn just enough to kind of understand the pros and cons, and then you'd apply the savvy you've developed over the years. There is a skill to doing this, and it's the same kind of skill that a senior decision maker needs to use to decide about something without truly being an expert in it. So the goal is to make good decisions, and the fundamental trait you need in order to make good decisions is to not be clueless. And so let me talk about the ladder of cluefulness, which we, I think, can help our policy friends climb. Here's the ladder of cluelessness. The bottom rung of the ladder of cluelessness, and unfortunately there are people who have yet to climb this rung, is to recognize that expertise exists, that there is such a thing as expertise in technology that some people have and others don't. The technology is not something that appears magically on the shelves of the Apple Store, and which you then buy, but it's something that is built by a community of people who have clawed a bunch of knowledge out of the universe over a long time about how to do stuff. And all of this know-how and all of the organization and so on, and that it's possible for a person to know about that stuff and predict what might happen, what might work, and help make good decisions. That's the first step, to recognize that expertise even exists. The second step on this ladder is to recognize true experts, to tell if we need to know something about the DNS, which of these people coming to us and calling us is a real expert in the DNS, and which is just a self-interested person who wants us to decide a particular way. And the top level of the ladder is to work effectively with experts to make good decisions. And I really feel like decision makers climb this ladder one step at a time. And it's a mistake to try to jump them up multiple levels. The good news is that more and more decision makers are climbing the ladder. Certainly I felt like many of the people I worked with at the FTC were at the top of the ladder. But not everyone is there, and part of what we need to do is help people to understand how to work with experts and recognize expertise. And one of the ways we can do that is to do the job well ourselves. So what about us? What does it look like? What is the challenge for us in working with decision makers? Well, there's a ladder here. The top of the ladder is to work effectively with the decision maker. Okay, but how do you do that? I think a lot of the common ideas, a lot of the sort of folk knowledge about how to work with policymakers in our community is actually wrong and harmful. And let me talk about why it's wrong and harmful and by giving an analogy. The analogy is this. Suppose that your friend Sam came to town, to your hometown. You're going to be away, but Sam wants to know, where should he have dinner? Now, Sam's the decision maker. He's the one who has to eat the meal, but you're the local expert. You know the restaurants, you know the town, and all of that. So how can you effectively help Sam make his decision? I'm going to walk through that process by analogy to the way we often think about working with policymakers. Well, the first thing we like to say one thing we often like to say in talking to policymakers is it's not our job to get involved in policy, that's dirty. We're just going to provide facts. So we will just provide the facts to the decision maker, then they can decide, okay? So you give Sam the menus from all the restaurants in town, you give him a textbook on nutrition, there you go. Now that's everything you need, oh, maybe a map. Now you have all the information you need to decide, right? Except that's not actually helpful, because this is not why Sam called you. Sam knows how to use Google to find the restaurant menus. He knows how to get a textbook on nutrition. He probably knows the stuff about nutrition he wants to know. That's not why he called you. He didn't want facts. What he wanted was your judgment, right? And by just providing facts, by saying we're not going to get involved in the decision making, you are taking away the most valuable thing that you have to offer, and instead you're dumping a bunch of irrelevant stuff on him. So that's not the right approach. Another thing we do, once we get past that often, is to go to the other extreme and just dictate the decision. We just say, okay, what would I want to do? And so let's say you really like a good burger, and so you're going to send Sam down the street to Five Guys and say, that's where you should eat. Now you're dictating the decision to him. Now that might be a good decision for him. It might be a terrible decision for him. Maybe he's a vegetarian. Maybe he's going to get his cholesterol checked tomorrow. Maybe he just doesn't like French fries. Whatever the reason is, you're not being very helpful by just telling him to go to the place that you would go to. And in a policy setting, you're overstepping, right? Because if you tell a policymaker just, you have to do this, the answer will typically be, well, who elected you? You were not elected by the people of the great state of New Jersey. You were not appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Someone else was, and they're the ones who have been vested with the authority by the people, and therefore they're the ones who are going to decide. It's not your job. And it's also not helpful. So that approach, just dictating the decision, also not right. A third approach that we sometimes want to fall back on is to just download our brains. Okay, I'm going to tell Sam everything I know about restaurants in town and how I like to decide and what advice I give people, all of my judgments about this. Well, you know, that place is really good if you go before 6 o'clock, but after six it gets really crowded, you have to wait a long time and the service is awful, etc. Well, okay, but Sam doesn't want a PhD in local restaurants. He just wants to know where to eat. So that's not so useful either, and it doesn't work. No decision maker has the time. Sam will tell you to shut up, and he'll make his decision himself. I assume he'll eventually get to that point. So what can you do that would actually be useful? In order to be useful, you need to find a way to combine your knowledge with the decision maker's preferences, or more accurately, with their knowledge and preferences, because there are things that they know that you don't know. In working with, for example, in working with my boss at the FTC, I knew a lot about the technical issues and often the positions of the different companies and groups on a particular question. But my boss, the chairman, knew what could actually be done politically. He knew that if we did X, then Senator Y would be really angry and we wouldn't be able to achieve our goal. So knowledge and preferences. This is often sort of misstated by saying it's your facts plus their values, but it's not facts plus values, it's knowledge plus knowledge and preferences. So how do you actually do that? Well, here's how you do it with Sam. You ask him a lot of questions. All right, Sam, how much time do you have? What's your budget? Are you a vegetarian? Do you like spicy food? Do you have a car? Are you a foodie? How much do you care about atmosphere versus quality of food? Are you an adventurous eater, et cetera, et cetera? Tell me about a restaurant you like in your hometown. You get all that information. Now you have an idea of what he actually wants, what he actually likes. You have his knowledge and preferences. Now you structure the decision space. That is, you don't make the decision for him, but you say, here are a couple good options. Well, you know, there's a pretty good Italian bistro just across the street from your hotel. It's really convenient. It's maybe a little more expensive than you wanted, and the food is only good and not great, but it's super convenient. Maybe you want to go there. But if you're in an adventurous mood, you're willing to ride in a cab, there's a great Ethiopian place over in such and such. It's got no atmosphere at all, but you know, it's an experience, it's a culinary experience that you won't forget. Whatever it is, based on what he's told you about what he likes and doesn't like, what he's willing to do, what his budget is and all that, you give him a few choices and you say, here are your choices and here's the pros and cons of those choices in terms of the things you care about. That's a process that actually works. And I often use this as a model for trying to understand how to work with a decision maker to get them to a good decision. So one thing to notice about this is that it involves a lot of communication. A lot of communication over time. That you have to ask Sam a lot of questions, you'll get answers, you'll ask follow-up questions. If you're smart, after he's done this, you'll ask him, hey, what did you decide to do? How did it work out? And you learn some more about what he likes. Now, next time he comes to town, you're in a much better position to give him advice more quickly, more efficiently, and he may tell you more about what he wants. This is a multi-round protocol. It has to be. In order to be effective, you have to be engaged over time. So the success of this depends on engagement over time with the decision maker, and it depends on building an environment of trust with the decision maker. So that they come to trust that the advice that you're giving them is given straight, it's honest, and you're not trying to push them to what you want to do. You're not trying to dictate their decision through the back door. And that they're willing to trust that you've done your homework and that they're not going to make some horrible series of tubes blunder by taking your advice. And you need to learn to trust that to let them make the decision. And it's that engagement over time and building of trust that allows an actually productive relationship to happen and that leads to better policymaking. Until we do that, it's going to be very difficult for us to influence the way policymakers actually work. All right, so what is the role of our community then in trying to improve the policy process? Given that we need to be engaged, that we need to build trust, it follows that if we're going to have real influence on the political and policy process, we need to have boots on the ground here in Washington and in other capitals. There's no substitute for actually being there and engaging with a decision maker over time and building that relationship of trust so that when something important comes up, you can call them and say, hey, I see this thing is before you, and let me tell you, it would be a mistake to do X, and here's why. Or let me tell you, there's a factor you might not see. In order to get people to take that seriously, they have to know you and they have to trust, have built trust over time that you are giving them, that you're a source of good advice. So we need to have people here. We need to have people here over time. It's all well and good to send letters. It's all well and good to sign petitions, pay visits to your legislators or policymakers. That's all good. I, at the FTC, love to have people from my community come and visit. I think have enough visits or enough sort of email saying, hey, take a look at this, as I would have liked. But nonetheless, true influence comes from having boots on the ground over time. So what does that mean for our community? First of all, if you're at a career stage where it's possible, I would urge you to consider doing what I did, what Steve is doing, and what other folks in the community have done. And that is taking a time out, taking a sabbatical from your career, coming and working in your government. There are positions, a growing number of positions, where folks with the knowledge that's in this room can really do a lot of good in moving the policy process forward. There are a lot of operations type positions as well, a lot of tool development, a lot of funding related things that that folks in our community can do. But I would urge you also to work in the policy oriented parts of the government. Take some time and do it. I spent a year and a half, and I think that I think a year is probably the minimum length of time that you can be productively, that you can do something like this productively. So if you're at a career stage to do this, consider doing it yourself. You'd be surprised how much you learn, how many interesting people you meet, including many interesting people from your own community who come in for meetings with the decision makers. For people who are earlier in their careers, for people who are at the entry level, our students now, we need to figure out how to build a career path that involves doing this kind of work. I saw this at the FTC. We had some excellent entry-level technologists, people who were really good and contributed a lot, had high impact within the agency. And then we had my position as the chief technologist, but the challenge was how a person could get from that entry-level position to a more senior position. We need to figure out, we need to work with entities in government to figure out how to develop a career path for people who are really good, strong technologists and want to do policy-related work and build a career in doing it. There are paths for this, but not nearly as many as there could be. We also need to think about how we should structure the way that we train people and deal with people to make sure that a person who chooses that kind of career path is able to stay integrated with our community and able to get the benefits of participating in our discourse and being able to do things like attend conferences and publish papers and all of that. We need to make sure that it doesn't, that this kind of work doesn't become a sort of ghetto that people can go into but not come out of. So we need to think about how to create that career path and support it. This is something we can do in universities and training students. It's something that companies can do. But it's also something we need to think about as a community, how to engage. We need to think about how to build incentives for people to actually do this so that it's not seen as a second-class job and it's not seen as something that someone does because they were unable to do real work. Because this work actually matters a lot and the quality of people doing it is very important. This stuff is really important for us. If we've seen anything happening in the policy world over the past 5 to 10 years, it's been a move from a situation where most policymakers didn't deal with internet and technology issues to a situation today where there is a hearing, there is some kind of inside the beltway event every day about our stuff. There are important decisions on the plates of senior decision makers all through government and in the legislature every day that relate to our stuff. We see the law encroaching on things we do. We have concerns about things like the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the DMCA, and other laws. That gets fixed through these sorts of processes. We see things like SOPA and PIPA bubbling up. That's not the last time that something like that is going to try to happen. There are a lot of important things that are going on here, and not just threats to what we do, but also important opportunities that are not being identified. We have an opportunity to do a much better job of educating the next generation of computer scientists, which we are not seizing, partly because our government doesn't know how to do it. This stuff is really important. This is one of the most important issues facing the country and facing other countries in terms of how to build a future that's actually going to be good. And we need to be in the room when these decisions are made. There's a saying in Washington that the most important thing is to be in the room. And certainly that's the case, to be in the room when the decision is made so you can speak up. We need to be in that room because these sorts of decisions are much too important to be left to politicians. Thanks. So I've left ample time for Q&A, which this is a topic that is, I hope, lends itself to that. So please come on up.
I'm Tony DeBora from Johns Hopkins, and I have an observation I'd appreciate your comment on, and that is what I see to be an important apparent paradox that's emerging in society. And that is that the more information becomes accessible to people, the more uninformed their behaviors appear to be. And I believe that the underlying reason is that people are more reluctant to say, I don't know. Could you comment on that, please?
Sure. Let's see. Well, certainly I think experience has shown that making a lot more information available to people has not made people a lot smarter, has not made them much better decision makers on the whole. But I don't know that I would go as far as you did in saying that, in at least implying that it might actually be actively harmful. I think we put too much, it's easy to put too much faith in access to information, but without recognizing enough how people need to have skills to use that information. And this partly goes to the idea that politics is not a search for truth. If somebody's not searching for truth, if they're searching for confirmation of their existing beliefs, then more information may make it easier for them to do that. But I think it's always been that way, in the sense that when people didn't have information, there was a tendency to fill in the gaps in a way that was convenient. Instead of picking and choosing from low-quality facts available to them, they could just make assumptions. I think it's really important to understand how we can turn information access into better decisions. And it's something we can try to do as a community, but understanding the sociology, the anthropology of political information is something that's really important. And I think it's going to take a long time to work out. I think we're just starting to see the impact of information technologies on politics and political debate. It's going to be really interesting to see it develop going forward.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, my name is Yulia Yon from Google. Can you hear me? Yulia Yon from Google. So I would actually like a practical piece of advice from you.
Okay.
For those of us who cannot take a sabbatical right now, but would still like to start building a trust and a relationship with people in Washington or in mm-hmm. policymaking positions, how can we do that? How can we actually reach them and start saying, hey, about this issue, I believe X and Y?
Sure. There are a bunch of things you can do. One of the important things to do is to identify a contact point on a particular issue. There are many issues going on, and you can start with one issue or cluster of issues and try to find a particular, either a policymaker or else their staff who you can talk to. As with anything else, identifying who's the correct person to talk to is a big part of the challenge. And if there are members of our community who know, or there are organizations that have worked with governments over time. I'm thinking, for example, of USACM, which is the ACM's Public Policy Committee. That is a group of computer scientists who engage with these issues. And one way to dip your toe in the water is to get involved with a group like that. IEEE has a similar group, IEEE USA. that's certainly one way to dip your foot in the water, to learn a little bit about what's going on and how to engage. But often it's true, getting that contact with a person to build the trust with, to have a relationship and discussion with is difficult. And sometimes the person is a staffer. As I said, you know, senior decision makers have a lot of demands on their time, and they rely a lot on support from their staff. And having a well-educated staff member, educating a staff member well, may have a bigger influence than talking directly to the decision maker. So that's another opportunity. And many of the staff members in places like this, especially on Capitol Hill, are young and maybe people who are reachable through school networks or something else. Or if you're in a company like Google, your own company has people who engage with government, although probably typically corporate government affairs people prefer to do that stuff themselves rather than having employees speaking, certainly on behalf of the company. But there may be opportunities to learn more about what's going on and about certain issues. I think over here.
Greg Shannon from Carnegie Mellon. So one other thing for they may have a legislative affairs person Yes. that they can contact with, and they're usually eager to work with people who want to engage on the issues. So the question is, can you talk about how it felt to actually have people listening to you and maybe doing what you suggest, and kind of how that changed your thinking,
Sure.
or how that affected your thinking?
Yeah. So actually, the suggestion about university legislative affairs people is a good one. And actually one more that I should have added as well is there may be somebody you know from this community or somebody from this community, like Steve Belevin currently at the FTC for the next, 2 weeks?
About 8 days.
Right.
Days.
So somebody like me when I was there, or Steve, or Henning Schulzerin has been at the FCC. You know, people who come out of the tech community who are in government, just a cold email to those folks often will be productive. Then the question about what was it like to have someone listen to me. Well, first of all, you know, I should say that I did a lot of due diligence before going into the job. And so I think I had a realistic understanding of what I might or might not be able to achieve. And one of the things that became clear is that in figuring out what to do, I really needed to work with the people within the FTC who had a lot of important knowledge I didn't have, like the congressional relations people, who really understand where the pieces are on the congressional chessboard, and how those relationships need to be developed. People who work with other decision makers and so on. In order to get something done, you really have to socialize the idea within the government. And there are lots of other people who have expertise that can help you do that. And I found myself, I think, much more in a web of people who, a team of people who were bringing different expertise to a problem than in a sort of situation where I was talking and then people were taking advantage of what I said. Certainly, that was the case. But I knew going in that that the folks I was talking to would trust that I knew what I was talking about on the technical stuff. And I worked pretty early on to develop a rapport with them about the policy trade-offs. I think I'm a little bit more hopeful about the possibility of accomplishing something in this kind of position, having done it. I certainly recognize that it's very hard to do anything in government, and that the government was designed that way on purpose. Checks and balances, the checks and balances that you read about in your civics textbook affect every single government employee every day. There are a lot of people who need to be kept happy in order for you and your colleagues to be able to keep doing their jobs. And it's difficult to do things. But certainly I learned much more about the mechanics of doing that. It's closer to university politics than you might think. Over here. Oh, I'm sorry, far left, yes.
Hi, William LeCoulter with Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. So I'm just wondering, how did you learn all this? Did you know this day one? Was there a finishing school for you before you started?
Not really. So I'd been working on policy issues for a while. I got involved in tech policy initially through two things. One was the coming of the DMCA, where tech policy really intruded into my world. And another was time I spent working on the Microsoft antitrust case, working as an expert witness and advisor to the Department of Justice on that, where I really got to see government decision making and the interaction of law and economics and politics and technology in an interesting way. So that got me interested. I spent time studying and working on it. I worked on it through ACM and other groups and engaging in the policy process. I started to go to lawyer conferences about these things and sort of get integrated in that community. So it was a long process of talking to people. At the time that I started, I think there was less knowledge within our own community about how to do it. I think there's more now than there used to be, certainly more interest in these issues. But it's something you have to learn over time. And much of what I said here is not, I think I would not have been able to give this talk before I worked in government. A lot of it is shaped by the experience I had.
Joe Canary, Technical University of Denmark. Thanks, Ed, for your talk. Good stuff. One question I have is, having now been a professor in Europe and worked with decision makers and politicians in three different countries, there's a difference between the politicians and decision makers I've worked with and those in America. And I'm wondering if the difference matters, because I found it frustrating. In particular, as an example, in Denmark's legislature, we do not have a single person educated in science, engineering, medicine, or anything else, mm-hmm. whereas as well as in, for example, ministry positions. But in America, that tastes different. Does it matter? Should I have been as frustrated as I was dealing with professional politicians?
Certainly the lack of politicians trained in sciences and technical stuff generally is a real issue. I am lucky living in Princeton, New Jersey, to have be represented by a congressman who's an honest-to-goodness physicist mm-hmm. with a PhD in physics, and you can talk to him in terms of statistics, and he understands what you said the first time. That's a rare thing, but truly rare, that if you look at the Senate plus the House of Representatives, you have, three people maybe who have science, technology, math, serious training, and that becomes an issue. A lot of it goes to the culture gap. Much of the culture gap, I think, comes from the fact that there are these very different career paths, and it plays out in different ways. One of the things that drove me crazy, especially at first, was an assumption in some circles that knowledge of technology disqualifies you from participating in a policy discussion. If you know about technology, you must not know, it follows that you probably don't know about policy. And in some circles, that's difficult to overcome. Of course, we do that to them too, right? Someone who actually walks in, a member of Congress who walks in here and starts talking about technology might actually know what they're talking about, but we'll probably think, oh, that person's a politician, therefore they don't know. I think that culture gap is partly driven by the fact that there are so few people in the senior positions who are trained in our disciplines. But I think that will change. If you look at the junior people at the junior staff level, people who are maybe in their late 20s, early 30s, you see a lot more who are more sophisticated. You see a lot more staffers who have taken computer science classes. You see people sometimes even who have bachelor's degrees in some of these positions. I think in the long run that will be helpful. Nonetheless, it's a problem that we don't have people in with serious training and expertise who play a role in that community and feel like they fit in. This is one of the reasons why, by the way, it's important to let people build a career, because often the path to being a senior decision maker starts with being a junior staff member and climbing that ladder.
I came up in response to the person from Google, but excellent talk covering the bases and a great call to arms. I was going to suggest that the best way of getting involved is a long-term approach. Every 2 years, there's something called a campaign. It's sometimes, congressional campaigns can be quite exciting, actually, and state rep and Senate ones as well. But what they also need are people who can set up the printer, make the router work, keep the wireless up, talk to Comcast when the line's down, and they don't have anybody who can do that. You'll probably also have to answer telephones and you know, walk some districts, but when you want to find out your legislative preferences, that's the way to do it, because they have a message that they want you to communicate to the voters, and that's how you learn it. Those people you're participating in campaigns with, about half of them are going to go on to be staffers. Those are the people who you are going to talk to when you want to bring up an issue on Capitol Hill. It's a long-term relationship building process. I've been working in campaigns every even numbered year since 1977-78 timeframe. And so when I came to DC and Capitol Hill on Monday, I stopped off and visited my senatorial offices because I already know half of their staffers, and one of my senators, chief of staff, it takes a very long time to build these relationships and to understand what he was saying. What are their preferences? Where are they coming from? It's not just enough to go in and tell them what they ought to do. But for people at Google, I'm sure the company will give you a month off at, you know, in October to go and work on a congressional campaign. Most companies will do something like that. Yeah. That's what I would suggest.
This is, I think, excellent advice. And I would even maybe go a little bit further, which is that there is a transformation going on now in how political campaigns are run, a move to being much more analytical, much more data-driven, much more analytical about the sort of strategy and dynamics of running a campaign. And that means there's a need for technical expertise. And a lot of people in the political world know they need some of this tech magic that the Obama people had. They don't know what exactly it is. But a lot of it is the kind of stuff that is our bread and butter as computer scientists. So I think the opportunity to apply that your expertise to a campaign is actually only going to grow. And there's a great opportunity there to build that relationship. And certainly engagement over time with your own representatives is one way to get there.
So I think this will, I'm Chris Watzek from Georgetown. I think this issue will be alleviated a little bit as more people move into, you know, kind of what you're suggesting. But how do we help people now identify, as a community, how do we help people identify who the experts are? So identify quacks, for lack of a better word, because there are a lot of them in technology, possibly because people don't know a lot about it.
Yes. Well, one thing that is important is just to help people recognize what kinds of credentials are actually signify expertise, right? You could tell so-and-so, you know, so-and-so is a longtime member of the Internet Architecture Board, right? To us, that means something. To somebody in the political world, maybe not. It's just, you know, some internet-related thing. Some of it is that. Some of it is a networking thing, right? My friends from the FTC will sometimes call me up and say, hey, we want an expert on topic X. Is person Y a good choice? Do they know what they're talking about on that topic? So that networking also helps, right? And some of it is just general BS detection skills. And that's something that Steve will probably agree with this. I found that often that was my role in a meeting. That my goal was to sit there and either call BS or not call BS on what somebody was saying. And it wasn't so much that the things that they were saying required a lot of expertise, to do. It's just that I could say that's wrong. You know, any sophomore computer science major could say that's wrong, but I could say that's wrong while being an Ivy League professor, which somehow is better. Yes. So partly it's a long-term education process. People knowing what, you know, that someone being the program chair of the USENIX Security Conference probably means they know what they're talking about when it comes to security, or even being on the program committee, knowing what that means. That sort of stuff goes a long way. That's part of it. Part of it, though, is this strange, seemingly strange to us model that often applies in DC debates, where credibility comes from not from knowledge, but credibility comes from having a stake in the outcome, where the fact that somebody works for company X is much more important than who they are or what they know. And the fact that company X has a stake in the outcome of the issue there is actually seen as qualifying that person to give advice about how to do it. And that seems backwards to us, but there are actually reasons in terms of political incentives for why it would work that way.
Hi, I'm Michael Hicks from the University of Maryland. So I'm wondering about advice you can give us going the other direction. So this talk was about how experts can help policymakers. If I think of my job as a researcher, as a professor, I think I'm trying to serve the public good. I'm trying to help produce ideas that are reproducible, that other people can take and create more ideas and hopefully help society. And that's going to influence policy. So is there a way that we as researchers could do our job better, that the enterprise could be better run based on your experience?
Sure. I think this is, in some ways, it's like technology transfer, right? That research is valuable on its own. We're building this, you know, wall of knowledge brick by brick, you know, you know all the metaphors there. But to the extent that you can think about choosing problems, for example, based on how they connect to policy issues that matter. Some of it is things like which problems you choose. Some of it is ways of communicating your results, to go beyond publishing a paper for this community, to spend some effort on explaining the significance of your work to policymakers or to the public. Sometimes just emailing someone in government you know who might be interested. This happened to me a bunch of times. Somebody just, you know, somebody who I knew in this community would email me, hey, we've got this new paper that you might be interested in, that somebody there might be interested in. I would look at it and either pass it on or not. That's also useful. So I would think of it like technology transfer, roughly, right? You're choosing problems and you're communicating. And I've found, I had a sort of career change, career course adjustment about 10 years ago, where I started doing policy work, policy research, in addition to computer science research. And so now I actually have a hat as a computer science professor and a hat as a public policy professor, and I have to be taking my tie on and off as I cross that boundary. But one thing I found is that it's surprising how often knowledge and research in one area helps me pick a good research topic in the other area. Understanding what matters from a policy standpoint can help you identify problems that you might not identify otherwise, and vice versa.
I'm Scott. I'm with the Cybersecurity Research Group at DHS. I'd like to shift your focus a little bit. You talked about communications between sort of the technology, the technical areas, and the policy world, whether that's executive or legislative or even judicial. Without necessarily going into specific instances, can you say something about where you see that conversation working reasonably well today and where it's not working very well? And I'm talking problems now or problems you see coming that we're going to have to grapple with.
Well, let's see. Where is it working well? Well, so there are some situations, some problems. I think cybersecurity as a government policy issue is a very difficult one for a whole lot of institutional reasons. I think we understand the problem really well, and we would be ready to move toward a solution if a strong and definite strategy emerged. So that I say is a partial success. I found in actually at the FTC, I think the discussion around consumer privacy was one where we had a robust interaction between the research community and government, which didn't always mean that each group did what the other wanted or was totally happy with what the other community did, but at least we had a lot of interchange, a lot of flow of information, and a really productive conversation. I think that's an area where the research community has had a lot of influence. That's an area where I can tell you that FTC commissioners read papers written by people in this room and may adjust their thinking. So I think that's one. I also think there's a good history of a lot of the basic sort of the way in which the government helped to bring about the sort of birth and growth of the internet and then set it free in a relatively in a relatively good way. I think the story of the government fostering the growth of the internet and then not messing it up too much actually is a real success story, and one where some very smart and thoughtful people in government and in the tech community were able to work together well. I guess if I had to point to one success, that would be that. It would be that.
I'll ask another if nobody
sure,
else
please.
Will.
Sure, please. Oh, go ahead.
What's your sense, or what did you take away from your experience here with what you see happening both technically, legislatively, elsewhere in the world that then comes back to us also?
Well, that's a tough one. You're definitely, you know, working within a policy part of the U.S. government, you're definitely U.S. focused. There's no doubt that relationships with your peers in other countries matter on some issues more than others. As a law enforcement agency, cooperation with our international colleagues mattered a lot because a lot of the, especially the technology-related scams that we dealt with were international in nature. I found that, and of course, the relation to international, the political process and the policy process in other countries is something which was primarily handled by a specialized group of people within the FTC who I would work with. So I don't feel like I have much greater knowledge of how this plays out in a political and policy way in other countries as a result of having done the job I did. I saw glimpses into that, but most of what I know about that is I learned through channels that I still have, that, you know, just people here, for example.
Thank you.
So, hello, I'm Jean-Pierre Hubot from EPFL Switzerland. Could you come back to the topic of privacy that you alluded to in the previous response? To be more specific, as you know, many people in the world make use of services provided by US-based companies, and some of those services might be a bit sensitive from the point of view of data protection.
Yes.
And there might be also some difference of perception about privacy between, for example, US and Europe. Mm-hmm. So to what extent, in your experience, is the FTC, let's say, motivated by making sure that the image of American corporations is, let's say, pristine from that point of view as perceived by citizens of the world?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, so let me talk about that more generally. And the first caveat I have to give is that my time at the FTC was before all the recent revelations about U.S. government surveillance. So that was not an issue that I dealt with, although I certainly have opinions about it. Also, the mission of the FTC relates to, if you divide the space of privacy into privacy as against government, as opposed to privacy as against companies. The FTC only worked on privacy as against companies. And that's still an area in which the perception is that the US is more lax in data protection than Europe is. What I think I saw was that, actually it's a little more complicated than the common view, that the rules in Europe are more strict on companies in terms of behavior, but the US has stronger enforcement of the rules it has.
Yes.
Partly because the FTC institutionally has more power, for example, the power to issue subpoenas, compared to many of the European data protection authorities. The need to work together and to have a single set of rules that companies can follow is very important. That said, the FTC is an agent of the US government and therefore is fundamentally going to be more interested in the opinions of US companies and people than in non-US people. They're interested in the opinions of the people they represent. And it certainly is important, the image of US companies and the question of whether people around the world can trust US companies with their data is very important. It's something the FTC is aware of. One last piece I would add to this is that the FTC, as a law enforcement agency, is in the business of enforcing the laws that Congress has given it. And so if something is illegal under current law, the FTC can bring an enforcement action to stop it. If something is undesirable but doesn't violate any current law, the FTC does not have power to stop that. Much of the job of FTC lawyers is to figure out how to use the authority that's been granted in ways that are consistent with the with good public policy. But there are certainly things that you wish you could stop, that any reasonable person would agree should not be happening, that fall into a gap in the law. And to the extent that a few US companies exploit those things and give a bad image to the others, I think that's a problem. But that's a problem that can't be fixed by the FTC by itself.
If you allow me a second very quick question.
Yes.
I think in my understanding is that in the US, the FTC takes care of aspects that in some European countries is actually covered by two different institutions, mm-hmm. which are the local FTC and the local data protection agency, right?
Yes, that's right.
If I refer to the case of Switzerland, France, and Germany, it is like that. Do you see this as a weakness in the case of the European case, or does it bring more independence vis-a-vis the government, or both?
So the question is whether it's a good thing to have a separate data protection authority as opposed to having it wrapped into the general consumer protection portfolio, as it is in the U.S. It's partly a historical accident, I think, in the U.S. that things are shaped this way, and that given the lack of a broad baseline data privacy law in the US, data privacy enforcement has fallen under language in the FTC Act, which simply forbids unfair or deceptive acts or practices. Perhaps it might not be obvious in advance, but a lot of the privacy law enforcement that needs to happen can be fit within that. And that's what the FTC has done. I do think it's a plus to treat privacy as an aspect of consumer protection more broadly. And I do think it's a plus, actually. And I felt during my time at the FTC that the breadth of the agency's job, of its mission, was actually a plus because you didn't have these internal boundaries that made it difficult to work together. There's a saying that software takes on the shape of the organization that built it, and the same is true of government activity, right? If you draw a line in the org chart, if you separate something into a separate agency, it becomes more difficult to coordinate across that boundary. And I think it's a plus within the FTC that that those things are together in the FTC.
Okay, thank you.
On the whole. Dan.
Dan Wallach, Rice University. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the pipeline. Yeah. There are a lot of, the US military turns out to be pretty good about trying to pipe academics into helping them and working with them through things like the Defense Science Study Group. There's another Computer Science Study Group. These are like year-long tours where you spend a couple weeks a year you know, looking at big guns and big ships and getting briefings and things. See a lot of org charts too. But other parts of the government don't seem to have that kind of pipeline. You know, there's no pipeline to give you a tour of Congress and how the policymaking process works. What can we do to help build the pipeline to bring to cross the community lines?
There's a few things. One is there actually is something that is not as large as or intensive as things like the Defense Science Study Group or similar things. The CCC, the Computing Community Consortium, runs this thing called LISPI, which it's an acronym for something. What it is like a two-day boot camp on how to, on the government policy process and how to work with it for computer scientists. And people who are interested in getting more deeply into this stuff, I would recommend trying to hook up with that. Now, other activities come from within government, and the examples you gave, and that would be helpful. There is a job, there is this cultural issue of convincing particular agencies that they should care. That they, you know, there was a process to convince the chair of the FTC that there should be a chief technologist, that it was worth spending a precious staff slot on that, and that this would be a person you could talk to and actually get benefit from working with. And that was a lobbying process that started in 2008 or so, and which bore fruit in 2011 with me actually being appointed to the position. It's been a slow process to convince agencies that this is valuable. Staffing is a zero-sum game. And so by creating this position, Chairman Leibowitz had one fewer lawyer working for him. You know, now it seems like a no-brainer to say that when your ratio of lawyers to technologists is 250-1, then maybe having another technologist might be a good idea. Nonetheless, you know, they know exactly what that person is doing, and nowadays staffing is a zero-sum or negative-sum game, so it's hard to justify. It's a cultural change, and it takes time to do, and it takes lobbying. It took specific lobbying of specific decision-makers to get my position created. And it was done by people who had connections to those people.
You mentioned the relevance of the consumer privacy to the FTC mission, and I was wondering if you might be able to, if you might have any predictions or guesses about what the relevance of security might be. And so, I noticed earlier this year, I think it was February. I believe it was a FTC consent decree against, well, HTC, which listed a number of items, but the one that jumped, that I thought was fascinating in there was one of the counts or charges against HTC was that there were these security vulnerabilities in these pre-shipped apps, and that the failure to use reasonable appropriate security practices was an unfair practice, which under FTC's, you know, charter, I guess, authority over unfair or deceptive trade practices. So I was wondering if you might have any thoughts about what the relevance to security might be.
Well, certainly the FTC, it's by now well established that they can do this, that if a company fails to follow reasonable precautions, reasonable under the circumstances, and as a result there is a breach, and as a result consumers are harmed, then the FTC can probably bring a case. And there have been quite a few of these. The HTC one is, I think, important in the development of this area for the FTC because it was in some respects, and I can say this because I wasn't there when it happened, it was in some respects, you know, a more egregious set of security violations than some of the other ones. And also because it went to smartphones and that, you know, the FTC documents talked about, you know, used terms like Unix domain socket and so on, right? You know, and seemed to actually understand what was going on technically. This is an area that is important, and the FTC has actually been doing this for longer. Now, that said, this is only a small piece of the overall cybersecurity issue that the government has to work with. And one of the things I tried to think a lot about while I was there was whether it made sense or how to get the FTC more involved in talking about security. But the fact is, given that cybersecurity is such a big problem, and the FTC has this one little piece, which is essentially dealt with security breaches due to negligence by companies, that it was hard to make it a major thrust for the agency. That might change.
Hi, this is Sam Weber from NSF. I greatly enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
Most of it seemed to concentrate on having academia affect policy in a more effective way. I was wondering whether you have any comments about the opposite direction. Are there any academic research problems that come out of what the FTC is experiencing, which the academic community isn't aware of?
I think there probably are. Certainly, so for one thing, there has been a pretty good literature in, say, the law and public policy world about talking about the effect of actions by the FTC and so on. And I know that there's been some academic research that has been driven by sort of what the legal boundaries are. It's hard to get, it's a little bit hard to get specific. I think there are probably some interesting quantitative studies to be done about the effects of certain kinds of actions by the agency. Certainly, issues about the effectiveness of initiatives that they're doing, whether certain changes in law are affecting behavior. So, for example, there is a change. There's been a rewrite of the rule under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, recently, which changes some of the details of how third-party ads in web apps for kids are supposed to work. And there are opportunities to study the impact on various kinds of practices and information flow of point changes like that. A lot of that may, the question is, you know, and I don't have a good answer for you just right off the top of my head, is there research that requires, you know, real serious computer science expertise that flows out of that? And I'm not so sure. I think there probably is. But really, much of what the agency does is law enforcement in particular cases. And the fact that, for example, so you might look at something, you know, Dave talked about the case involving HTC, where the phone was shipped with all kinds of pretty serious vulnerabilities on it. You might look to see whether the level of security, the set of vulnerabilities or types of vulnerabilities on newly shipped phones have suddenly got better as a result of that. That's one kind of example. You can look at the effect of government of various actions of an agency. But the FTC is, on the whole, a relatively small agency, and much of what it does is sort of point law enforcement. So it may not offer the same range of research opportunities in understanding its impacts compared to other agencies that do a lot more stuff.
Alan Sherman, UMBC. Would you please give a concrete example of how your technical advice helped shape policy?
Sure. Let's see. This is a little bit tricky because, you know, the conversations that happen within the agency are under the cone of silence. I can talk about a way in which certainly there were, I can give you some types of examples. There were cases involving data breaches or data security cases, not the one that Dave talked about, the HTC case, but other similar cases where there are questions about specific precautions taken by a company were reasonable under the circumstances, right? Was it unreasonable to protect certain information in certain ways. Was it unreasonable to not do something that, you know, we would recognize, a particular thing we would recognize as a best practice? So I was involved in helping people make decisions about those sorts of things. It's particular try to understand, you know, what, where do you have a very strong case and where do you not? There were a lot of the cases that the FTC brings are resolved by settlement. That means you have this settlement document that's negotiated between the agency and between a company that has violated the law. There's often detailed language in there with carve-outs saying they can do this or that, but not the other. Often the nuts and bolts of how that stuff works is important to get right so that there's not, you don't leave a giant loophole, but also you don't over-constrain a company when it's not needed for enforcement reasons. I can think of some specific examples of that. Those are probably the best general sorts of examples. I hesitate to give a specific example in front of a recorder, frankly, given that a lot of this stuff is confidential and might affect specific companies in specific ways. But certainly there are a lot of ways in which the result of a specific result that came out of an agency process was different. Actually, let me give you one more example, which had to do with collection of evidence. Many of the cases that the agency brings about internet scams, collection of evidence is super easy. You just like have to take a bunch of screenshots of the fraudulent web pages. But some of the scams that go on are more complicated, involve more active exploitation by someone, and the question of how you build an evidence trail that would stand up in court, and how you do that in a way that doesn't tip off the bad guy that you're collecting evidence, you get into actually some pretty interesting forensic issues. And I did some real technical work, building stuff to help with collecting certain kinds of evidence. Another example of the general sort of area where I was able to contribute. Perhaps you can get me to talk more specifically off recorder. So I see there's no one at the mics, and we've reached the end of the appointed time, so thank you very much.